In this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, West Coast correspondent Amy Krell joins us for our review of Doctor Who, The Deadly Assassin. We also talk about the Doctor Who proms, the adventure game, and our upcoming meetup on Second Life. All that and more on this episode of Doctor Who Podshock. The following is a production of Art Trap Productions, brought to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy, and has been made possible by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. This episode brought to you by Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers. Go to arttrap.com/podshocksupporter to become a supporting subscriber. Support the show and get extra content as well. This episode also brought to you by Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. Check out their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. This episode also brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player.
Well, the trial was adjourned to Master. He pleaded Article 17.
He remains as ingenious as ever.
He will not escape.
Escape? Escape is not in his mind. Now he is hunting you.
It was a mistake to bring him here. We could have used anyone.
No. We could not have used anyone. You do not understand hatred as I understand it. Only hate keeps me alive. Why else should I endure this pain? I must see them, Doctor, die, shame and dishonor. Yes, and I must destroy the Time Lords. Nothing else matters. Nothing.
Live from a cash and carry Constantinople, this is Doctor Who Podshock.
Doctor Who Podshock.
Okay, well, let's do it.
No.
Whatever it is, if it's valuable, send it to us.
For the best in all things Doctor Who, it's Doctor Who Podshock, the podcast all about Doctor Who, the longest-running science fiction television program, with Louis Trapani.
Hello.
Ken Deep.
Hello.
James Norton.
Hello.
News.
Fabulous.
Reviews.
Oh, no.
And fan mail for James.
For 40,000.
Doctor Who Podshock from the Gallifreyan Embassy.
You know, that guy James was really cool. Oh, yeah, we blew that. Podshock!
I'm the Doctor, and who are you? And
who are you?
The Gallifreyan Embassy in its 25th year presents Doctor Who Podshock, episode 217. My name is Ken Deep, alongside Louis Trapani.
Hello, my name is Louis Trapani.
And across the great pond, none other than Mr. James Naughton.
Hello.
And heading in the other direction, one of our West Coast correspondents, the legendary Amy Krell.
Uh-oh. Am I so old that I'm legendary?
No, but you are legendary.
Thank you. Hello.
Or as we were discussing prior to recording, cougars dig Time Lords.
There you go. That's my book.
That's going to be Amy's book.
Yeah.
Turning to some Doctor Who news, the Doctor Who proms just occurred again recently.
Mm.
James, did you see it?
I listened to it on Radio 3. And seeing some of the pictures online, it looked fantastic because they had Matt dressed in costume and Amy as well in a stunning little number. And, of course, the Daleks were there and the Silurians and the vampires in Venice. And Matt was even walking around in the crowd with various different devices and interacting with kids and parents and things. It really was terrific. And I think you can still get at it online because it's available
for
7 days. Yes, it's split into two parts. There's part one and part two. And it gives you all of the track names, which is fantastic. And they even did some foray into things like they played The Planets by Holst. I think they played Mars, if I remember properly. And Murray Gold was there leading the show. They even played some...
At one point, didn't Karen Gillan take the conductor's spot? And
Yes, that's right, and stood in front of the audience. There was all sorts of crazy things going on. They even played some Wagner as well as some Holst and things, which is really, really cool. It's really nice, and if you do have the chance to listen to it, you can, as I say, it's all available still on the iPlayer.
So,
and it's not just for UK, it's not UK only as well.
Is it just audio on the iPlayer, or do you get to see the video as well?
I think it's audio. I haven't checked it out, if I'm honest. But given that the only way that, as far as I'm aware, that you could tap into it, even when you were in the UK, is other than obviously being there, that was the only way you could get the visuals. That you could only listen to it on Radio 3.
We had some Dr. Upachak listeners there in person.
Yes, so I gather, which is terrific and fantastic. And maybe they'll even have the opportunity to send us an email or an audio file, perhaps, detailing the experience of being there.
Yeah, I was in contact with one, and she said just she would. So so far, I haven't heard from her, but so we'll see.
Fingers crossed. I've just checked, and it is available online, but it is only to listen. As I say, because it was originally broadcast on Radio 3. But the good thing about it is that it's not locked down to the UK like a lot of other things on the iPlayer. And I think as far as this recording goes, there's a couple of days left to listen on the iPlayer if you so wish to.
Because I think it was Saturday, the last, like, was July.
It was the 24th. It was last week, yes. Yeah, it was last Saturday.
So they do 1 week, they allow you to fetch it.
Yes, everything on the BBC on iPlayer as a rule is available for 7 days. But for certain things, they also do something called a series catch-up so that you can watch. They did that with Doctor Who Series 5 with Matt Smith. You could go back, provided the series was still on television, you could still go back and catch up any episode that you'd missed. Be good, but with it being a radio program, they don't do that, unfortunately. But there's still a couple of days left to listen, so it will go offline this Saturday, which is the 30th at 7:30 in the evening UK time. That's when it's going to go offline.
And then after that, do they do like a pay per view type of thing? Though not you, but pay.
I think as far as I'm aware, they have released previous proms and things. You could buy it on CD. Whether or not they'll do it this time or not, I don't know. I think possibly. It's very, very cool. It's I was very sad not to be there, actually. The proms are always a cracker. Even it's great that they've started to branch out and do other things. It's not just exclusively classical music. Last year, I know they had the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain play, who were just absolutely terrific and have a terrific sense of humour. And they had this fantastic thing where everybody brought a ukulele to the prom with them and played along to Beethoven's Ninth, you know, the Ode to Joy thing, which was just amazing to watch. I'd recommend any check that. There's stuff online on YouTube, probably you can find that. And there probably might even be a YouTube version from the Doctor Who prom if you wait a couple of weeks. Because they definitely, I hope they'll release it on DVD. I haven't heard whether they definitely will. But
they did on one of the past ones, wasn't it? I think it was on Infinite Quest that they tagged it, or was it on Next Doctor? It was one of the DVDs they put one of the proms on.
Yes, they did. And
it was the specials box set, wasn't it?
Perhaps, because I know they've done several. They did a concert. They've done several concerts, especially for Doctor Who. But as far as I'm aware, this is the first time that it's been incorporated into part of the proms, as far as I'm aware. Although I could be telling a lie there. It may have been last year they may have done the proms, but I can't remember. But they've certainly had just exclusive Doctor Who concerts where they've had Murray Gold there conducting and had the Daleks and Davros and Cybermen and all the rest of it. So, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. They'll be, if not, release it on a DVD in some shape or form after going to all the effort of pulling it off and so on.
Well, speaking of releases, just as we released our episode of Doctor Who Podshock, speaking of and reviewing the video games, the adventure games, and we were speculating when they would release it outside of the UK, I think it coincided with the release of our episode. So I believe it's available now outside of the UK, now those Doctor Who adventure games.
Yes, it's available at direct2drive.com, which is IGN's... retail game store. It's all digital, as we sort of speculated, which is sort of a big rival to Steam, which I think is what we talked about at the time. Mm-hmm. And if you go there, direct to drive, two is in the number two rather than T-O, and you can download them. I don't know how much they cost, because being in the UK, it automatically directs me to direct2drive.co.uk. And of course, they aren't on the UK version of the site, because the games can still be downloaded free of charge from the BBC website if you live in the UK. It's just if you're outside the UK. So if you, as I say, direct2drive.com. And I think if you search for Doctor Who,
$4.95 for episodes 1 and 2, $4.95.
That's great. Dollars.
Yeah.
Now, there you go. Bargain. It's dirt cheap. You can't really complain at that, can you? I'd have paid that if it hadn't been. I'd have paid £5 or whatever to play them. It's worth it. It definitely is.
Some guy named Ken Deep liked this on Facebook.
I wonder who that is. But other than that, really, there hasn't been a fantastic amount of news in the past week. There's been a whole lot of rumours, and there's been the announcement that they will be releasing the DVD box set of the entire series in the UK on the 8th of November.
Yeah,
and the
right.
day after in North America, which is terrific. So you've only got one day to wait for it if you're in the States, which you... Technically, I suppose, because of the time difference, you would have had to anyway. So it's pretty much almost.
Yeah, they usually release those in November, and it's for some reason they do these things on Tuesdays. So
yes, I don't know why Tuesdays or Thursdays. It always seems They've shown the artwork for the box, although it's be it not the completed version, but they've listed all the special features. That's going to be on the DVD and all the additional scenes. They're going to put all the monster files on the DVD in terms of all the opponents, outtakes, the InVision commentaries, video diaries, all the confidentials, as well as all the trailers and promotional material that they've had on television to promote Series 5, which is terrific. And it's going to be on DVD and Blu-ray, of course, which is fantastic. So you get to see it in HD goodness, where it's available. But as far as that, I think that pretty much wraps it up for news, aside from the odd dodgy rumor, which we probably...
What, do you have rumors, James?
Well, there's been rumors that a chap called Nicky Wire... who is one of the members of the Manic Street Preachers, a British band, put a blog on the band's website saying that he was writing a Doctor Who script, which
because no real writers were available.
Well, exactly, which caused a huge sort of furor and people linking to it massively, and will have gotten them a whole host of promotion and links to their site and so on. But since then, very recently, I think within the past couple of days, he's clarified on Twitter that it's actually a fan fiction material, and it's not actually for the BBC. It's not commissioned by the BBC. Funnily enough, so I think it's just been a rumor that was he put out there to try and garner attention to his band's website and all the rest of it. There's been a whole bunch of Torchwood rumors, as we know. Russell T Davies has sort of come on board a little bit and spoken to various different magazines, most notably SFX, talking about the fourth series, kind of dealing with the rumors, especially the rumors surrounding Johnny Depp as the Doctor Who movie. Obviously, he's essentially debunking it. And there's just been also a whole host of press coverage, as we know, about Sir Michael Gambon and Catherine Jenkins in the past week.
Well, there's also an actress named Laura Rogers as well that's been cast for Christmas. Do you know anything about her?
I haven't. The name has never rung a bell with me. I haven't heard of her before. I haven't been able to find any pictures of her online, and I haven't really looked into the rumor in that depth, at that much depth. So I don't know if I could tell you whether the face rings a bell, if you know what I mean, visually,
right.
Whether I could identify her and tell her whether she's been in anything, unfortunately. But we'll keep our eyes peeled and see what happens in the future. What's going on, I suppose. So, yeah.
Yeah, and as much as Russell T Davies may debunk it, newspapers are still bunking it.
Well, of course. Yeah. But they're bound to, aren't they? Anything to get particularly in the UK, anything Doctor Who related, even the slightest, sells a terrific amount of papers. Because they know that they'll get a lot of young people to go out and buy newspapers. So I think that's primarily why they do it, because obviously in the UK, as well as it garnering a huge audience, both young and old, and a huge spectrum of different people, it's primarily popular with kids. It's a children's program primarily. So they know that if they put on the front page a small headline, you know, about Doctor Who, somebody's going to walk past it and say, you know, Mum or Dad, can you buy that paper for me? I want to read that bit about Doctor Who or whatever. So, you know, well, even the Radio Times and other magazines and things do it, because they know they're going to sell a huge amount of copies if they do it. So why not?
The latest is now someone from that new series, Sherlock, I guess the lead actor was
Holmes.
Yeah, was originally supposed to be in line to play the Doctor, and he turned it down or something like that.
Yeah, and I watched, because I remember last time sort of bigging up Sherlock and saying that everyone should watch it, because, of course, it's written by Stephen Moffat. It stars Mark Gatiss, and he also co-created it with Stephen. And then perhaps you should explain that it's sort of a modern re-envisioning, whatever the word is, a reboot.
Oh, it takes place in present day?
It takes place in the present day, exactly. So it's all based on the stories by Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I should say. Mm-hmm. They have nice little twists in there and things, and it's very, very good. Well, as you'd expect, because it's written by Stephen Moffat. And it's sort of like a mini-series, really. Each, I think there are only three episodes being shown, but each one is an hour and a half. So
okay.
it's effectively like watching three movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a terrific actor. The chap, his name, well, it stars... I'm going to shoot myself for forgetting the guy's name. Mark Gatiss plays... Sherlock's brother, Mycroft Holmes, and John Watson is played by, oh my word, I'm going to have to look it up, I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Martin Freeman.
That's the one, thank you, who'd of course been in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the British version of The Office, amongst many, many other things, whereas Sherlock himself is played by... Benedict Cumberbatch, sorry, I should say, who was most famous for playing Stephen Hawking in sort of a dramatization about his life, and who is a very terrific actor. And you really, if you watch it, you can kind of see him playing the Doctor, because he's got a lot of the way he plays Sherlock, you see kind of a lot of Doctorish sort of characteristics in him, you know, being rather quirky and so on. But it's,
Mark could say something like, the only difference, what's the difference between Doctor Who and Sherlock? He said Sherlock's on an hour later or something like that.
Yeah. Sherlock's a bit darker, basically. It's a, sort of almost like a dark version of Doctor Who. And essentially the first episode was sort of, it did draw a lot of parallels to Doctor Who, because the first episode was pretty much written kind of through the eyes of John Watson and him meeting Sherlock and essentially becoming his companion type figure, his assistant. And I thought that was very interesting and drew a lot of parallels to a lot of the season openers for Doctor Who, like Rose, mm-hmm. and this time like The 11th Hour, because it was sort of written through from Amy's perspective a little bit and through Amy's timeline.
Were there any cracks in the walls?
There were no cracks in the walls, although he does have a rather swanky, interesting pad, which is garnered rather in a 70s fashion. Nice brown decor everywhere on Baker Street, which I thought was kind of funny, and you can kind of imagine that for an interesting interior to the TARDIS. I couldn't help but make all these parallels between Doctor Who and Sherlock, but how could you, given that Stephen Moffat is right
in the corner, the home of Danger Mouse?
Not quite. It's very well done, though, and I would suggest anybody who hasn't seen it should do. And it's very interesting that all these rumours have come out saying that Cumberbatch rejected the role of the Doctor before, of course, Matt Smith was cast. So
I wouldn't read too much into that.
No, I of course. But, I mean, they're not exactly from highly reputable sources either, because it's Digital Spy.
Mirror UK is not a highly reputable source.
And The Sun, of course, as well. All these sort of high profile publications. But it's funny. Even the costume there of Sherlock's costume is very Doctor-ish. He's got a scarf and a long coat.
Yeah, well, so does everybody in winter in England. I mean, you know, you can't survive.
Yes. But this is why it's quite funny, because they're broadcasting it in the summer and it's set in winter. So I thought that was rather amusing.
Mm. All righty. So I guess what we'll do is we'll come right back with our review. We're doing a DVD review today of The Deadly Assassin.
Greetings. Live. From BT's text messaging center in London. It's Doctor Who Podshock.
This episode of Doctor Who Podshock is made possible in part by ongoing support from Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers. If you enjoy Doctor Who Podshock and would like it to continue, please consider becoming a supporting subscriber. For a low monthly subscription fee, as a show of support, not only will you be helping us continue and grow the show, but you get extra content as well, just like the last episode of Doctor Who Podshock, episode 216, which was an extra edition of Doctor Who Podshock. To become a Podshock supporting subscriber, simply go to thegallifreyanimacy.org or podshock.net and click on the Podshock supporting subscriber banner. If you are already a Podshock supporting subscriber, thank you for your continued support. It does make a difference.
Right outside the capital itself. I'm in trouble now. The Chancery Guards. What a welcome home.
It looks...
Yes?
If I didn't know better, Castellan, I'd swear it was a Type 40.
It is.
But that's impossible. There are no Type 40s in service. They're out of commission. Obsolete.
Obsolete? Twaddle, take no notice, my dear old thing.
Nevertheless, Commander, this is a TARDIS. It's in an unauthorized zone. I want the occupants arrested. The barrier on this model is a double-curtain trimonic, so you will need a siphon and key to get in.
Very good, Castellan. I'll send for one.
After you've arrested the personnel, impound the machine.
Of course, Castellan. Will you want me to question...
Eventually, yes, but not on a presidential resignation day, Hillary.
Presidential resignation day.
Data retrieval. Request information on all Type 40 TT capsules currently operational.
Negative information. Type 40 TT capsules are deregistered and non-operational.
Report number of deregistrations.
304.
Report number of registrations.
305.
Report reason for numerical imbalance.
One capsule removed from register. Reference Malfeasance Tribunal Order, dated 309906.
Can I be of any further help, Castellan Spandrel?
1 minute, Engin.
Commander Hillred, Sector 7.
Malfeasance, Hillred.
Malfeasance?
The occupant of your Type 40 is a convicted criminal. Approach with caution.
Very good, Castellan. Set your stasers.
I must get past them and warn the president.
We're back with Dr. Hugh Podshock, and along with me is Ken Deep, James Norton, and the illustrious Amy Krell. I was waiting for a comment there, Amy.
So, I can't say. There's nothing to say.
So we're here, and we're back, and we're about to review The Deadly Assassin, which is out on DVD. It came out last year. It's a 1976 story. It was originally transmitted in October, from October 30th to November 20th of 1976, written by Robert Holmes and directed by the late David Maloney, and produced under the producership of Philip Hitchcliffe. So it's out on DVD now, which is the first time it's out in episodic form, because at least in the U.S., the VHS release was in an omnibus format, which had all the episodes kind of strung together in movie format. So it was good to see to have this available once again in episodic format, because it's how I prefer my Doctor Who, is in the way it was originally intended to be seen in that format. So this is an interesting story, because it's actually the first story that for the most part that the Doctor is companionless. It was a sort of an experiment there, and we'll talk a bit about that. It's also the first time we see an opening scroll with narration by Tom Baker in the beginning of this episode.
It was very sort of Star Wars-y, I thought.
Before Star Wars, yeah.
Not only did Star Wars rip that off, but also...
No. The Flash Gordon had it way before Doctor Who as well, so I think Star Wars is giving a nod to Flash Gordon.
But it's kind of interesting, really, that we've made that point, because there's so much, I think, that this story laid down in terms of sci-fi, and much has been borrowed from it, and so much has... I mean, first of all, it's clear that the basis for this story is, of course, the Manchurian Candidate, Richard Condon's famous novel, and that's a major influence in terms of the plot of The Deadly Assassin. And I think even one of the special features, which was, to my mind, probably one of the best special features on the DVD, was the Gallifreyan Candidate. We'll talk about that a bit later on. But so it's interesting how that, from that point, it's borrowing things from a novel. But even then, after that, so many of the things have been borrowed from this particular episode. I mean, one of the big things in terms of the sci-fi concepts that you sort of had to get your head around a little bit was The Matrix, and the Doctor at one point sort of goes into this computer system tracking his enemy, not knowing much about it at the time, other than it being the Master and what he's done and what's going on.
And this is long before Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, long before Keanu Reeves or the Wachowski brothers.
Before
The Matrix, indeed. And it's clearly borrowed a lot from it there. And
cold-blooded killings in one day.
Flea-biting, Spandrel, flea-biting. Things will get a lot worse.
Not here in the Time Lord capital.
Where it might rouse some of them from their lethargy. They live for centuries and have about as much sense of adventure as dormice.
Nothing, Kestelin. There is no record of any Time Lord ever adopting that title.
I told you so. If there had been a DE on the Master, the first thing he would have done would be to destroy it.
According to Coordinator Engin, the Time Lord data extracts cannot be withdrawn without the fact being recorded. I thought that yours had been scanned recently, but he assured me it was impossible.
Rubbish! Anyone with a little criminal know-how could do it. I could do it myself.
More than criminal know-how, Doctor. Excitonic circuitry.
Child's play to the Master. Do you think this stuff is sophisticated? There are worlds out there where this kind of equipment would be considered prehistoric junk.
What is the Master like on mathematics?
He's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He's almost up to my standard. What's that?
The APC control.
APC.
Amplified Panotropic Computations.
Brain cells.
Trillions of electrochemical cells in a continuous matrix. And the cells are the repository of departed Time Lords. At the moment of death, an electrical scan is made of the brain pattern, and these millions of impulses are immediately transferred to the...
I understand the theory. What's the function?
Well, to monitor life in the capital. We use all this combined knowledge and experience to predict future developments.
Ah, like the assassination of a president.
For some reason, that was not foreseen.
Oh, yes, it was foreseen, Engin. It was foreseen by me. How very clever. This time he surpassed himself.
What are you talking about?
Well, don't you see what he's done? We Time Lords are telepathic. That's simply a brain storage system. He intercepted his forecast that the president was to be assassinated and beamed it into my mind.
Is that possible?
No. Yes, yes. He could do it. You said my DE had been scanned.
Yes.
Yes. He'd need a biography print to beam a message accurately over that distance. It makes sense, Spandrel.
Maybe, but why?
I told you. Because he has an old score to settle.
Doctor, I simply cannot believe that anybody could do what you're suggesting. How can one intercept a thought pattern within the matrix itself?
By going in there and joining it.
You mean a living mind?
Well, in a sense, that's all a living mind is, electrochemical impulses. If I went in there, I could discover where he intercepted the circuit.
I couldn't allow that. It's too dangerous. The psychosomatic feedback might kill you.
I'm aware of that.
It's never been done.
Well, it's better than being vaporized. And that's what's in store for me if I don't produce the Master.
Let him try it.
Well, all right.
It was quite, as you said, Lewis, it was a very revolutionary series of episodes because obviously Sarah Jane had just left. He was a hugely popular companion, probably the most popular companion in Doctor Who history. The Doctor, of course, being drawn back to Gallifrey, having a message to go back to Gallifrey, having to drop Jane off in Croydon, or at least what he thought was Croydon, which actually turned out to be Aberdeen.
This isn't South Croydon.
Yeah. And having a premonition about the president, the Lord President, being shot just before he could reveal a successor. So, of course, he lands and it transpires that it's all due to the Master, who played rather brilliantly this time. I suppose it was quite a nice reveal that it would be the Master, because when you first sort of see the Master, he's not in his usual form. He looks nothing. There's no goatee. There's none of the usual black gloves or anything. And I think they even mentioned on the DVD that they were really wary about doing it in that way, because it was quite horrific for the time. The special effects that they used,
Well, it makes me wonder. I mean, this was the first return of the Master since 1973, and, Roger Delgado, unfortunately...
And John Pertwee, of course, yeah.
Yeah, Roger Delgado, unfortunately, we lost him in a car accident, and so the character of the Master hadn't reappeared or been mentioned in Doctor Who since. So this was a mysterious return of the Master, played by, this time played by Peter Pratt, though we don't see his face, we just hear his voice.
Mm.
And but I wonder at the time if they were a little, I mean, because it was only a few years after the passing of Roger Delgado, whether or not viewers would associate this Master that looks nothing like Roger Delgado, you know, as the Master. Would they really make that connection? I mean, of course, in the narrative, they make it clear that's who he is, but wasn't really acting like the Roger Delgado Master. We have to assume maybe he had regenerated maybe one or a few times, you know, one or more times, you know, since we last seen him, perhaps, and maybe that's why he's different, you know, besides physically being different. But I wonder if anyone thought maybe it might have been distasteful, thinking that, you know, since Roger Delgado was in a car accident and, you know, I don't know, and just seeing then his character all falling apart on screen, you know, whether
or not. Well, you know, it is just, I think, a continuation of the really clever way that they deal with the fact that actors drop out of the role.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, I love the James Bond thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like James Bond's a Time Lord. But, you know, what do you do when someone dies? And also, what I don't know, and famously, you know, gentlemen, I've never seen any other episodes besides those three seasons of Tom Baker, some later ones and the new ones. That, you know, what was the previous Master? What was the resolution? How did he get to this point? Was he shown getting, you know, dying or something?
No, that's just, you know.
No, that's the point, because.
Yeah, when Roger Delgado passed away, he was killed. They just cleverly edited his last part together as well as they could and just moved on. You know, there was no wrap up to the Master's character. He was just gone. And that was it.
Wherever he's alive.
Come on, what's happened?
Horrible. Horrible.
What are you talking about?
My technician.
Where?
In the camera.
Good grief. What's happened to him?
Matter condensation, a particularly nasty sort of death.
No wonder we couldn't find him.
I've never seen anything like it.
I have, I'm afraid.
You have?
Yes. It's a technique the Master picked up somewhere on his travels.
Who's the Master?
Who's the Master? He's my sworn arch-enemy, a fiend who glories in chaos and destruction.
The Time Lord?
Yes, a long time ago. You know, a lot of things are becoming clearer.
Not to me.
If the Master is here on Gallifrey, then this represents the final challenge. It explains why I was brought here. There are old scores to settle. And that's just a sort of greetings card.
Shut the thing up. Lancelot, we're still waiting for you to find the last sequence.
You see, it's here, Castellan. You can tell by the numbers.
I can tell when I see it. Take it to records. I'll have a look at it there. I want to know all you can tell me about this Master. And I warn you now, if there's some private feud between you, do not try to settle it on Gallifrey.
It cannot be avoided. Like it or not, Gallifrey is involved, and I'm afraid things will never be quite the same again. Shall we go down?
It is interesting, and, you know, again, they talk also in the bonus material, and, you know, I know a little bit about Peter Pratt. If you're a Gilbert and Sullivan fan, you know about him, and he's a really famous Gilbert and Sullivan, you know, lead, and he just has the best voice, and you can, you know, it just makes the character for me. You know, the makeup is great, it's scary, but just hearing that voice, and I think that leads to, you know, we can talk about it a little later, but how great the acting is in this episode.
Yeah, they said in one of the, I don't know if it was in the commentary or one of the extras, that you know, he was hired really for his voice because they knew he wasn't going to be seen under the mask, so they wanted to get someone that would have, that really have presence with his voice.
Yeah, it is. It's in the bonus, and they show actually a clip of him out of the makeup, which is interesting to see. Yeah.
Well, I just want to make a comment that, you know, speaking of the DVD itself, I think it was a good release. It's the video quality on the DVD, you know, To Entertain, you know, and the restoration team did a great job in restoring the video. It's interesting because our last DVD review was Robots of Death, which were one of the first DVD releases. So you can see, and this is, well, it's not one, it's from last year, but it's still, you could see how well they progressed with, you know, cleaning up the video and really making it crisp and clean. And also, it, credit goes to the original production because it was great lighting. Dudley Simpson did a great job with the music, you know, that sets the scene for this whole episode. And, you know, of course, David Maloney's outstanding as the director. And even now, looking back at it, many of the visuals containing effects may seem dated because, you know, they were using CSO and whatever technology they had on hand, they were doing the best they could. But many of the scenes that the visuals that they employ to elicit certain emotions work very well even today because just the way they were shot, different angles, and the way they were lit, and I think it still holds up very well today.
And I think, you know, the way that they're integrated is mm-hmm. so much better than most episodes. And I was thinking, oh, you really like this. And thinking about my favorite episodes, they're all the same team. Philip Hinchcliffe, David Maloney, Robert Holmes, and Roger Murray Leach.
Yes, you know, he was the designer.
Yeah, there's just such a great team. And again, you know, listening to Roger Murray Leach say, you know, what they had to make this and how much money and, you know, and I mean, you can, the thing I was watching on my TV, and obviously this isn't a Blu-ray, this isn't just a standard def thing. You can see every line where the joins are between, you know, in fabric and in the set and everything, but it still looks so incredibly impressive.
Well, he came up with that iconic seal, which was originally used in, you know, Revenge of the Cybermen with the Vulgons, but this is the first time it's being used, you know, as the, you know, the seal of Rassilon is being used on Gallifrey, and now it's, well, that and the costumes, like you said, and everything from this point on is now set in stone for really what Gallifrey is about. The only caveat is that here we have these lovely color-coded robes and all that, and it seems like today that it's like all red.
Yeah. But, you know, it is, again, what they made out of nothing is so impressive to me in this episode. And again, just, you've got a show, and this is also one of my issues overall, is it's not a kids' show, it's a family show. And they mm-hmm. do say this in the commentary. Yeah. It's a family show. So you need to satisfy the kids through the parents or
it's very
us.
Tricky. Yeah. Mm.
And there's so much in this one. I was going on, gee, I wondered, the first time I saw this, I was about 15 years old, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, yeah, that's pretty much an adult, more or less. But like, what could little kids take away from this except being scared crapless? I mean, it's really.
that's what you should do behind the sofa.
But it's not even that, it's so cerebral. And it is action-y, and it you know, it has a great pacing. And these guys, you know, Wang Chiang has incredibly great pacing too. But I'm just kind of, you know, just trying to figure out what was it. You know, it again, the language you said, you know, Runcible the Fatuous. Who I had to look that up. and the Sherlock Holmes references and the steampunky kind of look at the beginning and all that. It's just, you know,
steampunk before steampunk.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty early steampunk. I mean, yeah, the old control room is steampunk, very much so. But it's just it's so advanced and it's so technically great and it's just a bunch of really smart people making this show for the family show that shows at tea time, right? And I was just really impressed by that. And again, having no money.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Terrific job.
Well, it struck me as well watching this after seeing, you know, Matt Smith's series when, you know, notoriously the budget has been severely cut from what they had with their Tennant and with Christopher Eccleston even, what they were able to achieve. And really those sets are so impressive on Gallifrey, the, you know, mm-hmm. the idea to set it underground and, you know, having the, you know, saying, okay, what money do we have? How can we make this believable and make sets look terrific without a great deal of money? And they were so creative with it. And it kind of makes you wish that, not to sort of take anything away from the current production team or the fantastic work that they're doing, because obviously the past series has been amazing, but you kind of wish that they would do more stuff like that. Like, why couldn't the Silurian episodes have been set on another world? And, you know, why are we always so drawn to Earth all the time? Why can't we go off and do more things with Gallifrey and so on.
Yeah, well, I've been saying that for the past 5 years. But
well, exactly.
And they fear that, today's audiences won't, you know, accept it, I guess. I don't know. They feel
it'll be too sci-fi.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the time that we go into, well, and I could talk about that. I've been told no space, you know, and trying to go to Sci-Fi Channel. You know, they want Battlestar Galactica, but they don't necessarily want things to take place in space. It doesn't make any sense. One of the things, though, is it's so much more expensive to be off-world now. I mean, before you could go inside the soundstage and put up a set and, you know, and make it look, you know, Roger Murray Leach had 8 pounds and there it was. But now just you can't sell that. It's much harder to sell it. You have to build a lot of stuff. And then visual effects are expensive. We've had this conversation, you know, offline about, you know, sometimes you can do them cheap, but you can't if you're doing a show in the UK. It's going to be very top dollar, and they're having to do them in high def and all that kind of stuff. So it's expensive for them to do that. Here you kind of have the willing suspension of disbelief, where you're looking at this thing, and yeah, I see the set shake, but I don't really care. I'm not thinking about that, which, you know, leads me back to how wonderful the acting is, because you're looking at such great acting. I don't see the sets after about 30 seconds. You know, I'm looking. George Pravda was fantastic.
He's tour de force, absolutely.
And, you know, Angus McKay, and, you know, we talked about Peter Pratt and Bernard Horsfall. He's phenomenal, Bernard Horsfall. And they're wearing these silk hats, and they're wearing dresses, as Tom Baker says in the commentary, which is very funny, talking about, you know, Roman Catholic and, you know, wearing dresses. And, you know, but you put that on, they're wearing, like, silver makeup, which I now see. I never noticed that. I just noticed that in the DVD. And lipstick, and white lipstick, like the 60s, like go-go dancers. And you know, I don't care, you know, because it's Shakespeare. And the script is so just phenomenal, and just sell it so well.
It seems the key in classic Doctor Who. Doctor Who fans are always aware of the writing. I mean, that's one of the attractions for Doctor Who fans to be Doctor Who fans is the writing. But for me, the key beyond that is to get the actors, both regulars and supporting cast, to believe in it. When Tom Baker is believing it, it's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And you know the difference between Tom believing it and Tom mailing it in, which he's done, you know, later on. And then he just gets away with it because he's Tom Baker and he's just fantastic and it's kind of light and campy. But the Hinchcliffe stuff, for some reason, that era gets everyone to believe in it and sell it.
Well, it seems like Tom Baker and Hitchcock got
extraordinary production design, and then the actors just sell it. And like you said, George Pravda and Bernard Horsfall and all them, they just – no one on that set said, oh, geez, we're doing science fiction this week. Oh, you know, there wasn't any of that. That's what they were doing. They went at it at 100%, and that was it.
But that's what these guys do. I mean, this is – you know, this is why I love these guys. I mean, everyone. And – God, who is it? Not only Eric Chitty, who's great. I mean, even Hugh Walters, who played Runcible, Fatuous. You know, they were saying he's doing someone who was a news announcer at the time and, you know, sort of doing an homage to that guy. But he just is so invested in that. And it's a pretty small part, but, you know, you love the interaction. And you're right, Tom, and he does say this in the commentary. Tom said, this is the best time of my life. I loved this. I loved it every day. I was Doctor Who 24/7.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not the first
time
he said that either. He said that in other, you know, commentaries from this period. So,
and absolutely, and it makes sense. Again, I think that one of the things, and I can only speak for myself because I was here in California and not back on the East Coast, and we had these three seasons, the Hinchcliffe seasons, and that's it for years and years. I didn't see it on PBS. I hadn't lived here at that time when they showed the Jon Pertwee. But I mean, those were, I think, the best of Doctor Who. And I know the best episode is another one that Graham Harper directed that I haven't seen. But, you know, there's just, you could take these three seasons and, you know, show me a really bad episode. There isn't one. There's so much care and love in this. And Tom is so on. And to me, that's what it's about. It's about how devoted and into it that Tom was. And he just carries it with him. I mean, you can see him. It's brilliant acting. It's just really brilliant. He's doing some silly things, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a minute. Don't you know what t-shirt?
Well, it's silly on a not on a slapstick sort of way. He has a few little things in there. And I was giving this some thought because the series that we're doing, this episode and Robots of Death, which we did last episode, is sort of a series that we're recommending to people who may have come to Doctor Who recently, you know, in the last few years through Chris Eccleston, David Tennant, and now Matt Smith, and may want to dip their toe in the water of classic Who. And we recommended Robots of Death, and this is one of the episodes I'm recommending, and get putting some thought behind it. I thought, while watching it, this is a great serious episode. There's just enough of Tom being that Tom's funny eccentricity to get the flavor of it without it being overwhelming as you might see it later on in his run.
Yeah, but you know, there's always an undercurrent of humor in all of these, and you're talking about The Manchurian Candidate, and if you haven't seen that film,
the original, you mean, or both?
Yeah, well, the later one. I love Liev Schreiber, but
the remake was pretty respectable. I was one of those things that I'm sort of getting annoyed at remakes, and I think we've all discussed that at some point. That unless you're bringing something new to the table, what's the point of doing it? And they did a, you know, they gave it a good run. That was, I think, Jonathan Demme did the second Manchurian Candidate.
I can't remember. I think you're right. But, you know, the first one really has a very interesting history, you know, that, Frank Sinatra had produced it, and he's in it, and he stars in it, and it came right before the Kennedy assassination. Of course, he was close to the Kennedys and pulled the film and basically pulled it out of distribution. So, you know, you can see it for years and years, and now obviously it's back, and it's brilliant. It's just completely brilliant acting. And what I was a little surprised, you know, at that point, they you know, shot for shot in this documentary, they do show how shot for shot there are things of, you know, particularly the shooting. Spoiler alert! How like frame for frame they've actually framed the shot the same way, and that, I mean, that's so cool. Can you imagine that, doing stuff like that in a family show? Again, it just shows the level and that people, you know, that obviously Maloney and Robert Holmes and of course Philip Hinchcliffe, seeing these things and being able to bring that and bringing such sophisticated things to this show. And I guess that's what I like and what challenges me about Doctor Who of this era. And how I can watch them over. I mean, we were just talking about how many times we watched this before we were speaking today. And I think between us, you know, I've seen the documentaries twice. I watched it like 1.5 times through with the titles and then with the, you know, commentary without it. It doesn't get old. This one's just riveting. There's something in there. Now that I can actually see, you're right. I had that VHS tape for a couple of years and I broke it. I mean, I watched it so many times.
One of the things this was probably the DVD I was most anxious to own because the VHS was cut into the omnibus format, and this has three of the greatest Doctor Who cliffhangers.
Yep.
One of them, I mean, it has one of the most legendary, it probably has the most controversial scene in almost 50 years of Doctor Who, with Bernard Horsfall holding Tom Baker under the water and choking him and drowning him. I mean, that's
giving Mary Whitehouse a heart attack.
Yeah, it was the thing that pushed her over the edge and started, you know, I mean, there was probably a lot of things in her life that pushed her over the edge, but on Doctor Who, that's probably the thing that triggered her to push back against Doctor Who.
Real quick, let me just mention, and I was trying to share this with you guys. I'm going to send the link right now to you. There's a movie called Filth, The Mary Whitehouse Story.
And
it was on in the UK, and it's also it was on PBS, so you can find it. It's quite interesting. It's funny. It's very funny, but it really explains this, who Mary Whitehouse is. Because I knew who Mary Whitehouse was, you know, why? Well, because of this episode and that. Yeah, but it's, anyway, just as an aside, it's worth seeing. It's a very, very good film.
And so, brilliantly acted by Julie Walters as well.
Yeah.
Who people might know her from things like, she's done a lot of work with Victoria Wood and in Dinner Ladies, and she's an amazing actress.
She's Mrs.
actress.
Weasley.
Yeah, she's Mrs. Weasley, of course, in the Harry Potter films as well. Yeah, but she's an amazing actress because she not only is she a fantastic comic actress, but she's also very much a serious actress as well. And she started off in sort of comedy and things, and she's taken on board very serious roles. And this was a very interesting period in television, and I can think of nobody better to play her, and she carries it off superbly.
I see, James, I thought you were going down the road of saying, well, she plays drama, but she plays comedy, and it's meant to be a dramatic piece about, you know, a biography of someone's life. But deep down inside, there's an element of comedy.
Oh, yeah, there is.
Like her. I mean, to me,
absolutely.
I find people like that very laughable.
Ha-ha, Sherrod, you are.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, it shows a lot of the things and what, you know, you don't really realize in terms of the history. You know, we're all just laughing about Mary Whitehouse and how nuts she was and things. And, you know, a lot of it came from she had very strong Christian roots and things. And
always the root of all problems.
Yeah. Well, and they were showing this one particular scene where she manages to get through to the director general of the BBC, who at the time was it was quite an important time in the BBC's history, where they were trying to really be creative and bring new things to television and kind of push the envelope and sort of see how far they could get with things. And
she wanted nobody touching her envelope.
Well, that's it. And you know, basically, they're sort of sitting there, the director general and all the people at the BBC are taking the piss out of her. And it's a very funny scene, but she's really furious, and you know, and so there's a lot of a comedic element to it as well as a serious side. So she was a perfect choice for it. And well, we're distracting away from the point, but the point is, go watch that, because it's an interesting, it'll take about an hour and a half of your life, but it's a really interesting look into the lady's life, because, you know, really Doctor Who, I think, would have been different had it not been for Mary Whitehouse. And we always, you know, fart on about how she was a sort of prude and all the rest of it. I'm sure that at the time, a lot of the BBC executives were putting a lot of this stuff on the screen just to annoy people like Mary Whitehouse.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because this is the watershed, as it were, which is the prime time, right, moment for Who, because after this, the hammer came down.
Yes, exactly.
And it really,
well, the director general changed, and he had a really big, he was really very much a friend of Mary Waterhouse, and, you know, so the change was, you can almost click your fingers and you can see it. Yeah, sorry, White House. You can almost see it, you know, just clicking your fingers, see the difference.
Well, they edited this scene, that cliffhanger ending, for when it was retransmitted the year later, 1977, it was re-edited so that you didn't see the Doctor, quote, drowning, unquote, you know, which he wasn't drowning.
Yeah, and they had to take it off a VHS tape that somebody took off the air, which I find riveting, that you go into the actual master tape and cut that. It's like, ah, you know, it makes me crazy. But that happens so much to things there. You know, never do anything like that.
Originally on PBS, though? I mean, I don't recall it being edited on that.
No, it was on the PBS one.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. I mean, I should pull out the VHS tape again, but...
Because the DVD made it seem like they just had to, like, you know, reconstruct it from... because it was missing, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, I remember seeing it.
Yeah, well, you know, we might also be projecting about how much we actually saw.
Yeah.
You know, it might have just cut a little... I think it freeze-framed, and he's under the water.
Yeah, there's a freeze frame.
Yeah, it did freeze-frame, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it actually ran a little longer, Hitchcliffe was saying originally.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because all this business, because today it seems so mild by today's standards.
At the end of the day, and this is the thing that I would take Mary Whitehouse to task with, is here we are in 2010. This was happening in 1976. And as you can see, the world turned out fine.
You know, all those children that saw this episode that were terrorized by that scene have
right.
all become
I mean, how many,
mass murderers.
How many assassins were created from watching
They're all
this.
Deadly assassins now.
Yes.
They're all in the Al-Qaeda.
Our civilization is in ruins because of Doctor Who.
At the end of the day, there are more important issues to solve in the world than Tom Baker being held underwater in a television
show. Sure.
And if she really wanted to put her efforts into something, she could have gone and fed starving children or gone and taken out some test tubes and researched a cure for cancer. But no, she wasted her time. She wasted her time.
She wasted her life on this, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
No time for people like that.
It's also, you know, just so annoying that you can have that perspective as well in terms of, we must eradicate this from television, because at the end of the day, if people like it, people will watch it. If people are outraged by it, they won't watch it. So the problem will sort itself out, you know.
But it's nothing new to children's stories. There's been children's stories that had horrific, you know, content in it for ages. You know, Hansel and Gretel. I mean,
Hansel and Gretel were thrown in an oven.
I mean,
yeah, that's how you hook kids, because, you know, you want there to be this kind of disturbing, frightening element to it, because otherwise there's no hinge, there's no...
Yes, but the world is a disturbing and frightening place.
Well, exactly.
And showing them that, all you're doing is making them ill-prepared.
Exactly.
You know, you get out in the real world and go, this stinks!
Yeah.
The thing that's so much more disturbing to me, and, you know, I was trying to explain to someone, you know, that old... Like, there's a shot of Bernard Horsfall with that big old, like, syringe thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that scared the crap out of me. It still does. But just... You know, something, and I unfortunately don't sound very much like Tom Baker, but here, this is my favorite line. This, I think, is really key. It says, "You do not understand hatred as I understand it. Only hate keeps me alive." Oh, I'm sorry, this is not Tom.
This is the master.
It's the master, yeah.
Master, why else would I endure this pain? I must see the doctor die in shame and dishonor. Yes, and I must destroy the Time Lords. Nothing else matters. Nothing. You know, this is what's scary. I mean, this is really intense. This is probably some of the most intense emotion of any of these episodes ever. I mean, Wang Chiang is very interesting, and I really like it in Robots, you know, that's very interesting, and this is super intense.
Yeah. What I love about the brilliance of Robert Holmes and putting this story together, when you go into The Matrix, that's great on itself, you know, but all by itself. But he goes in, and the doctor's in there, and the things that he is seeing are real life horrors, and then he throws a few curveballs, like the fact that there's a clown in the story. There are people who are genuinely medically terrified of clowns,
and it's not difficult to see why, really, is it?
It's a
so there's
theme,
really
yeah.
no reason for a clown to be laughing at the doctor in the story, but he knows it's just another element of terror that a whole segment of the population is going to be just clawing at the couch about.
Now,
spiders as well. He puts a spider in. People are arachnophobic. You know, there are things in there. He goes out of his way to try to hit all these elements of fright.
Mm. And in The Matrix, what I didn't really appreciate or realize, you reminded me of this, Ken, when you were talking about the clown. All of the characters in The Matrix, other than the Doctor and, you know, spiders and so on, they were all played by Bernard Horsfall,
we should say that,
which I find is
he's playing Chancellor Garth. We neglected.
Yeah,
he's
playing
that.
Chancellor Garth, but he's also playing the clown.
Yeah.
And all the sort of steampunky characters in The Matrix trying to kill him, the train driver, ultimately the sniper, and all those are the clown, and all those are the characters are played by one guy who is a legend in Doctor Who, because, you know,
absolutely,
he's been in so many episodes. You know, I was looking
four stories,
and I was thought, the mind,
and
he's
the,
in the mind
the,
robber.
The perfect idea that he was one of the three Time Lords sentencing Patrick Troughton to his exile on Earth.
Yeah.
Yes.
And here they cast him again. And it's not explicit. It's a tip of the cap for people who follow the show. Because remember, these are days before VHSs or DVDs or reruns or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So you had to really know your stuff.
Years ago,
that this guy, who's, you know, this statuesque man, you know, with a great voice and great on-screen presence. Just fantastic. I would love to meet him. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's still knocking about. He's had a very prolific career. I mean, he's been in James Bond movies, for heaven's sake, and all sorts. I mean, it's unbelievable. His career has spanned decades, and he's an absolute legend and a gentleman. And I wanted to tip my hat to that, because he's he's one of my, aside from Peter Pratt, and he does a terrific job playing the Master, you know, Chancellor Goth, and he, Chancellor Goth himself is just brilliantly played, and I think that he really is sort of the Master's henchman, isn't he? And it's so brilliantly and wonderfully played.
Well, I also have to make an honorable mention to Angus McKay is Barusa in this story.
Yes.
Talk about, first of all, the performance is a knockout for again, a moderate part. Not huge, but definitely not a small part. He has great presence in the story. But beyond that, you could easily take a character in that situation and make the character a boob. Because here he is trying to manipulate the truth and some things like that, and it's very easy to dumb that down. And yet he has one of the best lines in the story. He says to Goth, Chancellor, it is by their decisions that presidents are judged. You know, that's just this great line. It's just a powerful line, and it puts the whole thing in context. And so here's this character who's been kind of making some questionable moves, but still has lines that bring the character back up again. It's part of the subtlety that runs throughout this story that makes it one of my favorites. And bringing this around a bit to making it a recommendation for someone who hasn't seen classic Doctor Who, and if you had to pick one, there's a couple of things here to go with. It's one of the best eras of Doctor Who. You don't have a companion to be introduced to. So if you're putting this on, new Doctor Who fans understand that there were Doctors before, David Tennant and so on and so forth. So you have this, you really just have to grasp on to the Doctor. And
you don't have to understand the companion as well.
You don't have to understand, oh, well, this person came from here, this is what they're all about. And I think what you have is you've heard about the Time Lords, and this way you can kind of see a little bit of what that's all about, what this society was all about. There's only a handful of Time Lord stories, and I might, as a just a matter of trivia, I think this is the only time that you see the Doctor dressed in traditional Gallifrey
Time Lord robes. And it's so comical as well, because the cap, it doesn't fit over his, you know, curly mop. It just looks ridiculous. So
let me tell you, hats and curly hair don't work.
Yeah, but I just thought that was really clever in a way, because it kind of, it showed that the Doctor stood out from the Time Lords, and that he was, you know, it embodied his character as being this rebel. Bohemian type guy, a rebel.
Yeah.
You know, Even in disguise, you can tell he's not like everybody else.
He doesn't move like them. You know,
he doesn't move like them. He doesn't act like them. He doesn't have the hair for the cap. It just doesn't look right. And that to me was really funny and really clever. Go on, sorry, Amy.
No, please.
No, go on, because I was going to talk about something else. So,
well, you know, it's there are a lot of oblique references in this episode too, and because my business partner, my producing partner Mark, has never seen Doctor Who, and I showed him Talons of Wang Chiang, and he loved it, and I had to talk to him though for about 5 minutes to set it up, because you do need to know some stuff for that one. This one, you're right, it's a very interesting introduction, because there are so many references, but they're really sort of self-referential. It doesn't really refer back that much, because there is no back to refer to. And on the documentary, there's this guy, and I'm sorry, I don't know if he's listening, who's going, oh, I hated this because, you know, that's not what the history of Time Lords was. I was like, yeah, it is, dude, because now it is.
Well, this is a very historic episode for Gallifrey, because we've seen Gallifrey before, but it was never fleshed out. Here you have the Gallifreyan culture, style, and society all fleshed out here through the genius of Robert Holmes, really, you know, put some thought behind it. And it's also the first time, even though we've seen Gallifrey and we've seen characters from Gallifrey before, this is the first time we actually care about the characters. I mean, Chitty, what was his?
Eric Chitty.
Yeah, and as we had said before.
Engen.
What was that?
Coordinator Engen.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, what Ken was saying with Barusa, Barusa's going to play a part in Doctor Who for years to come now. But it all started here.
Mm.
And, you know, the really wonderful thing about this, too, and this is good writing, and, you know, we talk about, you know, the stack of scripts, this 15-foot-high stack of scripts, you know, towering over the office here, is when people get very Basil exposition-y about stuff, where you go, yes, and you know, I am Barusa, and I was your teacher, and I, you know, there's none of that. He just makes a very oblique reference, and he
very
says,
subtle, absolutely. Very subtle. He says, when I was with him at the academy or whatever, and that's it. They let you put that together.
Yeah,
and he says that also. To Runcible, he says you had ample time to ask me questions. You know, that's it. And it was so fun. It was such a psych. You know, it was so.
And the way he dealt with it as well, the TV anchor, the way he dealt with it. Funny as well. So, oh well, he doesn't have time to talk to the likes of me. Ha ha ha! Sort of a thing. That was all of the characters were great.
But maybe Holmes was making a comment about media and, you know, reporting, and maybe that they don't have all the facts. And even, I mean, Runcible was a bit of a boob in here, you know, in this story. You know, he was even somewhat unfamiliar with regeneration because he said to the doctor, "Did you have a facelift?" You know, he seemed unfamiliar with that. You know, Time Lords can regenerate.
Well, maybe that's just what they call it. You know, I like to think that. I like to think they have their own little, like, you know, air quotes. About that. Or maybe, you know, regeneration. The interesting thing, but, you know, that's funny you should say that. Obviously, he is a Time Lord. Obviously, he's a Predonian, right? But he gets stabbed in the back, and he doesn't. We don't see him regenerate. We see him get killed. And I thought that was kind of interesting too. I noticed that today for the first time. I was like, well, he dies. Wait a minute. Isn't he supposed to regenerate? So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
You can regenerate unless it's like a fatal wound or something. You know, there's, you know.
Well, it has, as long as it's not really serious. But I think a spike in your back going through your heart's pretty fatal.
Yeah, maybe it went between. I said, yeah, how could it hit both his hearts, you know?
Or shrunk. Well, you know, if you thought if you'd shrunk, you'd regenerate and you'd be tiny. At least you'd be all right.
That's always been a little precariously when you regenerate, when you don't regenerate, because, you know, you've got, maybe Mind of Evil, you know, Pertwee's, did you realize one of your hearts stopped and all this kind of stuff? And I didn't regenerate? I'm not Tom Baker yet?
Well, just like Tom Baker off the tower, and then you had David Tennant falling from an even higher height, and he didn't regenerate afterwards. I mean, he did.
Yeah.
That wasn't the reason.
He did and he didn't. Yeah. Yeah.
Runcible, my dear chap, how nice to see you.
Oh, I don't believe we've, weren't you expelled or something? Some scandal?
Oh, it's all been forgotten about now, boy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Where have you been all these years?
Oh, here and there, you know, round and about. Oh.
Is there something the matter?
No, just a twinge in the knee.
Well, if you will lead such a rackety life. You had a facelift?
Several so far.
Yes. Well, nice to have met you. I must get on. I'm doing the PR video cast.
Yes, and splendidly too, if I may say so.
Oh, do you think so?
Oh, it's a gift. Somehow you have a wonderful way of making the whole thing come alive.
Oh, it's very nice of you. That's with the president now. He's just arrived at the Panopticon. Sure you're all right?
What? Yes.
Come on, you stupid yoik.
What?
Should be getting a signal from my camera technician up there.
No.
A little disturbance here in the Panopticon as the president starts to ascend. Already, the members of the High Council, led by Chancellor Goff, are moving forward to greet his super-ex.
But, I mean, we've talked about Barusa and Goff, but also, I think it's definitely worthy of mentioning about the chap who played Castellan and the guy who played the coordinator, who they really have very pivotal roles and actually
Bob does a home run in whatever he does. The man can read the ingredients on a box of Wheaties and you'd be riveted.
Well, of course, because George Pravda, of course, was originally from the Czech Republic, in Prague, and you can kind of tell that in his accent, at least I could the first time I watched it, and I thought that was quite interesting that they cast him in this very sort of British show, very much a British show, even though he was living in the UK and acting a lot in the UK at the time.
Well, you know, it's funny because he's, I said, you know, I bet he was in like a smiley thing. He's in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. He's definitely a spy movie guy.
With Al Guinness, isn't it?
Mm.
Oh, yeah. But, you just wait for the new ones to come out. That's going to be awesome.
But it was interesting because having George Pravda there and contrasting that and having the coordinator, Eric Chitty, who's very much almost a stereotypically English type character. I thought that was interesting because that was showing that even on Gallifrey you have, you know, people from different countries with different accents almost and all this sort of stuff, which I thought was really, really clever and terrific that they've done that.
No women, that is kind of
bizarre. I mean, they've changed that in the future, you know, in future episodes where Flavier and whatever, but you know, it's interesting here that you make, you know, it's a good point that you make that.
Yeah.
So it's a sausage party.
But I guess you could also argue that, oh, well, you know, maybe they were just all happened to be regenerated into guys at the time rather than girls.
Or there was a sale somewhere. You never know.
Well, it seems like it's not co-ed.
We're having a convention. We're all at a convention.
The warehouse was having a 90% off sale.
There's a sorority panopticon elsewhere on Gallifrey.
It's the Orthodox Jewish cardinal part of that. They're obviously separate, yes.
I thought it was also interesting the ratio of studio and location shooting where, I mean, you've seen this before in Doctor Who where they're shot on film on location and on video and in studio and all that. But here it was really segmented because you had parts like 2 and 3 that were pretty much all film on location. And I think the location shooting did a great job as well. They really fleshed out these other, you know, in the Matrix, you really felt that you were in a jungle or in the swamp area.
And it really needed that, I think,
they shot it
the episodes because otherwise
at a school, but you would never have thought that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's like Maloney. I mean, that's Maloney for you. If you look at Talons of Wang Chiang, which another one, those pop on info things are great. Mm-hmm. Okay, you don't have to read it. It's there. Oh, yeah, this makes sense.
Turn the text on the DVD.
Yeah, they were talking about how they decided to do Wang Chiang. They were going to do a Victorian thing in this. They decided to wait. They used it in Talons of Wang Chiang because they were working during the winter where it's hard night, like really early in the day, you know, at like 3 o'clock. That's it. It's nighttime in London, right? So they had they used that to their advantage to shoot longer at night. And that's what they did with the filming. So I thought that was really interesting too. You know, they did this during the summer. You have a lot of daylight in that part of the world and, you know, and just shot it. But Maloney also just knows how to cut stuff and how to be, if you look at it, it's shot in a very economical way. And obviously if you look at it, again, if you watch it once, you don't notice this, but you watch it like 3 times in 2 days, you do. How they're just in pretty much like 10 square feet of this.
But they pull it off.
Totally,
you know, and you had the elements working in their favor because, you know, here the character of the Doctor is looking for water, and it was actually a heat wave taking place during that time, and pretty much I can relate to it in this year as well. Here in the Northeast, it's been very hot, but it's the shot of the biplane, and I mean, they went out and they had to shoot a biplane in the sky, and that was incredible. You know, it worked.
Stuff
that you don't normally see in Doctor Who.
I mean,
the Doctor's bleeding on his knee. I mean, it's probably not the first time you see the Doctor's blood, but you don't see it all that often in Doctor Who.
I mean, we've talked about all the things that we love about this, and as to my mind, on the DVD, as we're kind of reviewing the DVD, the one thing I don't like about the whole experience of the DVD was one particular special feature, the Frighten Factor one, where they talk to various different, and I'm going to use air quotes here, experts about, you know, what makes Doctor Who so scary and yada, yada, yada. That's the only thing about this that I didn't like. Everything else was perfect. And it highlights to me kind of what Ken was saying about this being a really good story to introduce somebody to Doctor Who, because, or indeed if you're a newbie to Doctor Who, if you like, if you've only seen the newer series and so on, because I'd watched, I think, the first couple of episodes on my own, but then Lydia watched the last two with me. I mean, I put it on upstairs and she said, oh, I'll stay down here, I don't want to watch Doctor Who. She's seen series 5 with Matt Smith and loved it. And I think I'm secretly trying to convert her into a Doctor fan, and it's working, because she came up and she was like, oh, what's this? And, you know, I could tell she was really interested in it, because she'd ask very interesting questions like, oh, you know, who are those guys? And, oh, they're Time Lords, right? They're the Doctor's people, because, you know, she'd only come up with them. And, oh, but who's this other guy? Oh, that's the Master. But I thought all Time Lords were good, and I thought all Time Lords were dead. And so it had to go through and explain a few things, because she'd not watched it from the beginning. But she, coming halfway through, not knowing anything really about Doctor Who beyond the fifth series with Matt Smith, she was hooked on it. She was originally really sceptical to it. So that just shows you, if you can, you know, show this to somebody who has little or no interest in science fiction, let alone Doctor Who, and,
well,
you know,
she makes
she's only
a good
watched.
Point there. I mean, it's good seeing, you know, hearing it from fresh eyes, because, you know, you would think that, yeah, the Time Lords are supposed to be, you know, good guys or whatever, but here you see them as, you know, partly corrupt, you know, and this is going to be an ongoing legacy of the Time Lords, because from here forward, there's lots of corruption going on.
It's downhill, yeah, yeah. And that's why I thought it was really interesting, and that's why it's great to watch. I mean, the one thing that kind of annoys me a little bit about Doctor Who fandom is people seem to sort of berate new fans, particularly people who have only really seen stuff like Tennant or people who have only seen Matt Smith and so on. I mean, sometimes, yeah, they can be a little bit obnoxious or whatever. But, you know, berating them for not seeing the classic series. But it's so fun to sit down with a newbie and watch some classic Doctor Who for that reason, to hear what they have to say and, you know, taking it back to the beginning and so on. I've had some of the best nights in round D-Player or whatever, watching old black and white episodes of William Hartnell with people who've never watched a black and white piece of television in their life and have loved what they've watched. So, you know, do it. If everybody has to make it their mission to go out and convert somebody to old classic Doctor Who, and, you
like
know,
Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, be a missionary for Doctor Who. Yeah,
it
knock on people's
doors. You feel really
doors.
Old when you say that, James. You know, old, dire. Like, yeah, well, you weren't born, but some of us were, so be careful.
Well, it's funny, but, you know, teaching kids at the university who didn't know that there was a previous series of Doctor Who, that this was the first, this one with Matt Smith was the first ever, you know, series, and you're like, dude, where have you, first of all, where have you been for the past 5 years? And secondly, it's the longest running science fiction program on television ever.
By the
where
way,
have you been forever? Have you been asleep in a coma?
James is supposed to be teaching these guys science, but he's talking about Doctor Who. I just want to let everybody know.
That's great.
I've made it my point to try and talk about Doctor Who as much as possible when teaching physics or chemistry to undergraduates. And Lydia's mum is well, I was going to say making me, but that's not actually the truth.
No, she's making you.
She's a head teacher, she's a headmistress, and she wants me to go in to a primary school, and I think you call them an elementary school in the States, and talk about Doctor Who. So for me, you know, I'm going because I was shocked to hear this. So I'm going into primary school and starting them young and converting them. So there we are. We're Doctor Who mission.
Please take this tract by David J. Howe and let me know what you think. Ringing doorbells, handing them out. Hi, we're here about Doctor Who.
Have you heard of the Doctor? Praise be to the Doctor. As blasphemous as possible.
But yeah, well, I figured we took our cue from Tom talking about the Catholic Church in the commentary. So we were in the clear once he stepped on the
once landmark. He said that, he gave us the green light. Yeah.
By the way, just as an aside, you know, I have read that book, and obviously it's out of print. It's so worth reading his autobiography. And one of the best things, but I don't know, you know, I happened to be in London for a long time back in 2000, I guess, when it came out, and there's an audiobook version of it. Mm-hmm. It's the best thing I've ever heard. And I listen to a lot of audible.com is my favorite website. You know, I listen to
last 15 minutes of him reading his autobiography is probably, I honestly hurt myself laughing as hard as I laughed when he was wrapping that book up and talking about somebody stealing his bicycle and whatnot. I was honestly just hurting with laughter. So if you have a chance, the book is a great read. The audio book to hear Tom talking is, you know,
a joy.
It's like having him in the room with you telling you stories.
And talking about, you know, talking about this whole thing. And I think it's very interesting also, you know, I think in the descriptive commentary thing, it was talking about Robert Holmes. Like, was he referencing Parliament? Was he referencing the U.S. government? Which there is a, you know, what is it? Vaporization without representation is against the Constitution or something. But he said he was really sort of Catholic Church because there are cardinals and you know all that ceremony. But yeah, Tom really has a very
Holmes
interesting.
Deny that? Didn't he say that it was more collegiate? That his that comes from.
That was the interpretation,
but
of course.
But it's a blend of many things. Yeah. It's not particularly just one thing, and that's part of the brilliance.
Also, it's a product of its time. It's 1976. We just went in the U.S. We just went through Watergate, and you know the president, the Kennedy assassination wasn't that far. You know, before that, you know, 13 years before that, whatever. So, you know, it's
true that the assassination was. You know, was 63, but remember, they still had the Warren Commission and all those things. I mean,
that was going on at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All these events were in the news.
Yes. But also, I think that from a British perspective, we've always kind of been rather interested in political assassination in a way and rather had a rather morbid fascination because. Only one of our prime ministers has ever been assassinated, and that's going back quite a long way. You know, it seems that, you know, in the States, it happens every 40 or 50 years, whether you want it or not.
And
so,
in the story, it's Lord President, not Lord Prime Minister.
Well, again, this is the interesting thing, is that they really took it from that perspective, didn't they? They had a president rather than a prime minister. And,
a president, a chancellor, and a cardinal.
Yes.
You know, got a whole combination of
nice mix.
Equally offending everybody, which is the way I like it.
No one is spared.
Which is good. You know, that's smart people, you know? I couldn't come up with that. That's a very smart writer. And just.
You will confess, Doctor.
All right, I'll confess.
Very sensible.
I confess you're a bigger idiot than I thought you were.
There are 15 intensity levels in this device, Doctor. At the moment, you're only experiencing level 9. Much easier to talk.
Got nothing to say.
We all think of something. Soon.
Dum-dum. Turn it off. Tweedledee. I must apologize for my subordinate. He lets his enthusiasm run away with him.
I see. The hot and cold technique.
We are simply seekers of the truth, and we haven't got much time. Chancellor Goth has ordered your immediate trial.
I'd like to help you. How about a signed confession?
That will help. I hate going into court without possessing the full facts. Motive, for instance.
Now, that's a sensible question. Why should anyone want to assassinate a retiring president?
A personal grudge?
I never met him.
I know. I've seen your biog.
And you still think I did it?
I think you're going to be executed for it. They are preparing the vaporization chamber now. You have about 3 hours to live, Doctor.
What? Well, that's monstrous. Vaporization without representation is against the Constitution.
You are an embarrassment.
You realize I've been framed, don't you?
Framed?
Yes, framed. It's an Earth expression. It means that someone's got a great deal of trouble to get me into this mess.
Why did you come back here?
To try and save the president's life. If you remember, I left a note for you.
Yes?
Which presumably you did nothing about.
All that I could. So you knew the president was going to be assassinated?
Yes. In a way, I experienced it.
Go on.
Well, this is the bit you won't believe. People talk of a premonition of tragedy, but I actually saw it happening. I saw the president die as vividly, as clearly as I can see this room now.
And where were you when this happened?
In the TARDIS, traveling in Vortex, after I'd heard the Panopticon summons.
What do you think?
Precognitive vision is impossible.
He knows that, and he knows that we know it, and yet he maintains it happened.
And that's why you believe him?
I'm beginning to.
Nobody else will.
I think he's been framed.
Framed?
An Earth expression.
Huh?
You were going to check for me who had withdrawn the doctor's DE.
Nobody. I'm afraid you were wrong about that, Castellan.
I don't think so.
The machine is infallible. Data extraction is impossible without an operating key like this. And the code of the particular key is recorded here, opposite the archive number of the data extract. Now, as you can see, my key is the only one entered against the doctor's DE.
And how many of those keys are there?
Well, they're only issued to High Councillors. Nobody else is allowed to respect the DEs of Time Lords, except for yourself, Castellan, in the line of duty.
The record could have been erased, I take it.
You obviously have no idea of the complexity of excitonic circuitry.
No, I haven't, but if somebody knew what he was doing...
It would require a mathematical genius with a phenomenal grasp of applied excitonics.
Really? There can't be many of those on the High Council.
I love this stuff. I love really good writing.
Amy, is who on earth is Tom Baker on Audible by any chance? I mean, you're the Audible expert.
No, and I would murder for it. I have it on cassette, and it's signed by Tom. He was very impressed that I had that. This was the hello, are you American? Yeah. Well, what do you think about the election? And then, you know, he was autographing these things for me. We were in England and everyone's getting really angry because I was taking up all his time. Too bad, guys. But no, it's not. And this is one of the things that maybe, you know, because Lewis has pull with the Audible guys, you know, I would love to have to share that with everyone. I'm not going to do it because I don't roll that way. But to try to talk them into trying to get the rights to that stuff, it's like I think HarperCollins. Why do I know that? And they do have a deal with them. So do what you can. I know I have this weird.
I just went to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, and I'm looking now. There obviously there are lots of Tom Baker Doctor Who stories here, many narrated
and
by Tom Baker.
The 39 steps, right? And what else does he do?
Well, there's Little Britain stuff, too, here as well.
Lewis, yeah, Amy made a great suggestion off-air about a future podcast with her, and she had a suggestion
steps,
about...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All yes. The best and worst of Doctor Who actors outside of Doctor Who. So, like, Tom's best performance, and then maybe that odd turkey in there where he's running naked in the Canterbury Tales or something.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. Of course, we're not going to talk about this podcast. I figured that, you know, that's a lost cause. But the wet t-shirt. But the there are some. It's kind of. I think I did see the very worst thing he ever did very recently, and we should definitely talk about this. Through the magic of the internet, I saw something really awful that he was in. But yeah, But the audio, please, anybody who wants to write to Audible, I would strongly suggest it. It's, again, one of the best things. The other thing that he did was this Oscar Wilde thing that nobody has, that he was even more impressed that I had that. So anyway, there you go.
The Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations, both by Charles Dickens, narrated by Tom Baker as well, available through Audible.
Mm.
So, do that and then ask for more. I've been a subscriber for like 10 years or something with them, so maybe they'll listen to me. I don't know.
Wow, fantastic. It's
very good. All right, so we got off topic. So
so would we recommend The Deadly Assassin?
No, not at all.
That sucks.
It's crap. Save your money. No,
so we're going to have another show, though, about Tom Baker, you know, in the water. That's for later, right?
That's
Mr. Darcy. Mr. Darcy, we're not going to talk about that.
If you want to talk about Tom Baker,
why not? I can do
wet.
That's okay.
It'll get me major bonus points with the good lady talking about Colin Firth, you know, going through the water, because she, as part of me showing who, she's done a sort of deal with me where I have to watch,
now,
bits of classic literature and so on DVD, the dramatized versions, and this was one of the things on the list to
was it Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah.
You know what it
Pride
is, though.
Prejudice,
you know, it's not classic literature. It's not that, James. It's lady porn. Okay, let's just call it what it is.
I think it really is lady porn, because I've not met a single woman. When as soon as you mention Mr. Darcy, you know, they all go, "Oh yeah, that bit in the lake," you know.
And you know, that's not. I don't think that's in the book. I think I remember, because, by the way, you know, one of my favorite actors, Anthony Caff, who's in, now I've forgotten what it is. The one where he's cleaning the gun and they're looking for Heathrow Airport. What episode is that? I can't remember. Anyway, that's the only other Doctor Who episode I've seen, by the way. But I was listening to like a commentary on that DVD. They've released that on Blu-ray, so you can watch it in Blu-ray now. And I think they just did that. That it's actually not in the book. Not that I've read Pride and Prejudice, because you know I don't read books.
Oh, I'll probably have to soon. So I'll let you know, or I'll ask Lydia, and she can tell me whether or not it's in the book. The reason why she wanted to show it to me, she said it was the best adaptation. They did another adaptation recently with Keira Knightley.
Yeah.
Lydia simply said, "Oh, she should be in prison for that." Not the director or the writer or whatever. Just Keira Knightley needs to be in prison because of what she's done to Pride and Prejudice. So,
lady porn prison.
Lady porn prison. Yeah, I guess so. Even though she obviously didn't play Mr. Darcy or whatever, so I don't even know if it's in the movie version. I've been told not to watch it. I'm not allowed. I'm barred from watching it, so I can't tell you.
You know, but I'm liking her more and more every time you talk about her. So I think you've made the right choice here.
Well, she's made the wrong one. Time will tell.
Watch out, because it looks like her mom's got you also. So there you go.
There we go.
So, I have the Cougars Dig Time Lords special bonus Pod Shock episode discussing the Mr. Darcy scene in Deadly Assassin, and we won't do that. No.
I should make her watch that now and say, see any parallels between this and Pride and Prejudice?
I'm sure the people who did that Pride and Prejudice, I'm like turning around looking to see if I have it on my shelf. But yeah, I'm sure they watched that and said, you know, we have to do something like that with Colin Firth. You know, we can't let Tom Baker hold the mantle of the coolest, you know, wet T-shirt on BBC. We have to surpass
now,
that.
Was that all Tom? Because he did have a stand-in during those sequences. It wasn't Terry Walsh was doing Bernard Hurstfall's part there. So
He had a nipple double.
Nipple double.
No, I did say that. That didn't come from me, okay? That came from me. No, there was a guy, you could tell, you can see the wig.
Yeah.
When you have curly hair, you're wearing, you know, your hair gets straight. So whenever the hair is really straight, that's Tom. Whenever it's all curly, that's stunt double.
The wig
that's
was kind of obvious.
But it's still pretty good. I mean, it's cut so well. It's very, you know, and that's tough to do. But and it's scary with the poison and the water and everything. That whole thing is very.
That's I mentioned Terry Walsh. Hats off to the late Terry Walsh, who's always did an outstanding job doing these, you know, physical acting and stunt work in Doctor Who.
Mm.
Who's an actor as well? He acted in Doctor Who sometimes as well.
And an attendee at Who Event 85 in King of Prussia.
Yes. And just to comment about what James was saying about the special, which was the frighten factor, and I have to agree, this whole Doctor Who, you know, surgence of going, you know, I think Doctor Who works best when it's, you know, as far as, you know, being frightening is when it comes out of the story naturally, you know, when the story dictates it. Yeah, I think this story, The Deadly Assassin, is a perfect example, because all the frightening stuff in it just comes naturally out of the story. I just don't think when it tries to go out of its way just to be frightening, it's I think it fails a bit. I'd rather it just come naturally out of the story. I don't think, you know, every Doctor Who story has to have a fear factor, and you know, but if it does warrant it and if it comes out of the story naturally, then so be it.
Absolutely, but it just turned me off completely when within the first 5 minutes they had some psychologist come on there and give some dodgy definition about what fear is, like nobody knows what fear's about, and then they had a vicar or a priest or somebody come on and say that fear is an acronym that stands for, I think he said something like, yeah, and I just thought, oh my god, really, this is on a Doctor Who DVD as a special feature? Guys, you've done a terrific job with the rest of it. Why did we need this? Nobody needs this.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. But it's totally canceled out by the great, and I don't have the name of it, but that wonderful
the Gallifreyan candidate.
Yeah, when everybody's talking about, you know, Tom's talking about, you know, again how into it he was, and they show that the rehearsal, which I thought was, oh, I wish I could see more of that. There's a scene they're in some room, and there's you know, David Maloney and Tom, and they're rehearsing. They've got the scripts in their hands. And they're talking about how David Maloney was an actor. Tom's talking about that, I guess.
That one's called The Matrix Revisited. That was, I think, that's my favorite of the extras, The Matrix Revisited.
Yeah, and everyone just talks about it, and you can see the fondness with which they remember these things and how much detail they remember.
Yeah, Barry Letts in it, which was had to be shot just before his passing. He didn't look very well there, but I didn't recognize him at first. You know, you can hear him, you know, obviously in the lower third, this is Barry Letts, but if I had just, you know, bumped into him like that, I might not have not recognized him.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I love that behind the scenes stuff. It's nice, not to talk about Townes Wen Chiang too much, but they have like the line cut in that one where you can see them move from set to set as they tape. They just would tape in order, and they just pull through the set, and that's really fascinating too. I would have loved to have seen that kind of behind the scenes stuff, but this is just fabulous. It's the best documentary. Oh,
they also had some interviews with David Maloney, obviously recorded before he passed in 2006. They had some stuff from 2003 and 1999.
They showed, as I recall, what dates the interviews were from as well, didn't they? Which was kind of cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to give it 5 out of 5, or yeah, I'll give it 5 out of 5.
Is it possible to go higher than that? I mean, it's really that good.
It's 6 out of 5. It goes to 11.
It goes to 11, yes.
These all go to 11, yeah. No, I'd agree with Lewis, and well, I think we all think it's terrific, but as I've said, the one thing about the DVD which spoiled it was that frightened factor thing. All the rest of it is top-notch, so buy it, give it to all of your friends as act as a Doctor Who missionary. Just tell them not to watch The Frightening Factor.
Well, and as I say with all...
Scratch the DVD in that part.
As I say with all these stories from the past, is that you got to put yourself in the mindset of that period. So, you know, the pacing is going to be different than what you see in Doctor Who today. So, you know, if you're a newbie, you know, watching Doctor Who, you know, from years ago and you haven't seen it before, you know, you just have to put yourself in that mindset that it's, you know, like anything else. If you watch, you know, Columbo from that period or, you know, any other show, you got to put yourself in that mindset. Well, that's our review of Doctor Who, The Deadly Assassin. Please note that we did not receive a review copy of the DVD, Doctor Who, The Deadly Assassin. Our review is based on copies we purchased ourselves. Going back to what Amy was saying about Audible.com and how she was praising Audible.com, and she's been using Audible.com for a good 10 years now. As you know, Audible.com is the leading provider of digital audiobooks. They have over 75,000 titles to choose from in every genre, be it thrillers, business, history, science fiction, fantasy, and more. Audible content is compatible with iPods and iPhones and MP3 players and over 500 devices for your listening pleasure anytime, anywhere, just like this podcast. Now, for you listeners of Doctor Who Podshock, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial, so you have a chance to check out their service. To download your free audiobook today, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, A-R-T-T-R-A-P, for your free audiobook. Now, Amy was disappointed that they didn't have the Tom Baker autobiography audiobook, but you know what? There are lots of selections, as I mentioned earlier, of Tom Baker narrating various books and other titles there. You could choose one of those. And we usually select a Doctor Who title or something relating to the particular episode of Doctor Who Podshock. And this time we're going to do something a little bit different. It's not going to be science fiction. It's not going to be Doctor Who. But it is relating to the Deadly Assassin. And that is, we're going to suggest, possibly, if you like, to include as your free audiobook download, is The Manchurian Candidate. Yes, that's the piece of work that inspired part of The Deadly Assassin, and you might want to check it out. It's by Richard Condon, and it's narrated by Christopher Hurt. It's unabridged. It runs about 9 hours and 26 minutes. So this is a full-featured audiobook, and it could be your free audio selection. Now, let's hear a little bit from it. Now, I have to be honest. You have to... There's lots of flavor in this writing here, and just playing a small sample here, a short sample, is not really going to do it justice, but let's hear a little bit from it.
Like an angry man with a cane who pokes a hole through the floor of heaven and is scalded by the joy that pours down upon him. Raymond had a capacity for using satisfactions against himself. When he got off the plane at St. Louis Airport, he felt like running. He decided Mavoli's father must be that midget with the eyeglasses, like milk bottle bottoms, who was enjoying sweating so much. The man would be all over him like a charging elk in a minute. "Hold it, hold it," the pimply press photographer said loudly. "Put it down," Raymond snarled in a voice which was even more unpleasant than his normal voice. All at once the photographer was less sure of himself. "What's the matter?" he asked in bewilderment. Because he lived at a time when only sex criminals and dope peddlers tried to refuse to have their pictures taken by the press. "I flew all the way in here to see Ed Mavoli's father," Raymond said, despising himself for throwing up such corn. "You want a picture? Go find him, because you ain't going to take one of me without he's in it." "Listen to that genuine bluff sergeant version of police verso," Raymond cried out to himself. "I am playing the authentic war buddy so deeply that I will have to mail in a royalty check for the stock rights. Look at that clown of a photographer trying to cope with phenomena. Any minute now he will realize that he is standing right beside Mavoli's father." "Oh, Sergeant," the girl said. So then he knew who she was. She wasn't red-eyed and runny-nosed with grief for the dead hero, so she had to be the cub reporter who had been assigned to write the big local angle on the White House and the hero. And he had probably written the lead for her with that sappy grandstand play. "I'm Ed's father," the sweat manufacturer said. "It was December, for God's sake. What's with all the dew?" "I'm Arthur Mavoli. I'm sorry about this. I just happened to mention at the paper that you had called all the way from San Francisco and that you had offered to stop over and see Eddie's mother on the way to the White House. And the word somehow got upstairs to the city desk, and, well... that's the newspaper business, I guess." Raymond took 3 steps forward, grasped Mr. Mavoli's hand, gripped his right forearm with his own left hand, transmitted the steely glance and the iron stare and the frozen fix. He felt like Captain Idiot in one of those space comic books, and the photographer got the picture and lost all interest in them. "May I ask how old you are, Sergeant Shaw?" the young chick said, notebook ready, pencil poised, as though she and Mavoli were about to give him a fitting. And he figured reflexively that this could be the first assignment she had ever gotten after years of journalism school and months of social notes from all over. He remembered his first assignment, and how he had feared the waffle-faced movie actor who had opened the door of the hotel suite wearing only pajama bottoms, with corny tattoos, like "So Long, Mabel" on each shoulder. Inside the suite, Raymond had managed to convey that he would just as soon have hit the man as talked to him, and he had said, "Give me the handout and we can save some time." The traveling press agent, with the actor, a plump, bloodshot type whose glasses kept sliding down his nose, had said, "What handout?" He had snarled that maybe they would prefer it if he started out by asking what was the great man's hobby and what astrology sign he had been born under. It was hard to believe, but that man's face had been as pocked and welted as a waffle, yet he was one of the biggest names in the business, which gives an idea what those swine will do to kid the jerky public. The actor had said, "Are you scared, kid?" Then, after that, everything seemed to go okay. They got along like a bucket of chums. The point was, everybody had to start someplace.
All right, well, that's a little bit from The Manchurian Candidate, and that could be your free selection. To download your free audiobook today, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, ARTTRAP, for your free audiobook. So let's say you want to see The Deadly Assassin, and you listen to our review and you want to watch it, and you don't know where to find it. One of the most asked questions we get often here at Talk to Podchuck is, where can I find these episodes? And, of course, they're available on DVD, and you can purchase them on DVD, but there's lots of Doctor Who older episodes available on DVD, and perhaps you can't purchase them all. So then what can you do? Well, here's one solution, Netflix. Netflix is the world's largest subscription service streaming movies and TV episodes over the internet and sending DVDs by mail, all for only $8.99 a month. And you could try them for free. Simply go to arttrap.com/Netflix. That's arttrap.com/Netflix. Netflix. And you'll be watching The Deadly Assassin in no time. Once again, that's arttrap.com/Netflix. Hey, what are you doing this Saturday? Yes, this Saturday, the 21st of August, 2010. We hope you join us celebrating 5 years of Doctor Who Podchuck, wherever you may be. Yes, it's the summer, it's hot, it's sticky in the Northern Hemisphere, and for many of us, this is a chance to chill out, turn up your AC, or turn it down as it may be, and join Doctor Who Podchuck hosts, correspondents, friends, and listeners from around the world in celebrating 5 years of Doctor Who Podchuck, all without leaving the comfort of your own home. There's no secret locations or handshakes needed, no long car drives or train rides, no worrying about parking or finding a seat, no worrying about what to wear, well, at least not in the physical sense, no worrying about travel fares, dinner checks, tips, who paid what, who paid the last round, just kick back in front of your computer with your favorite beverage or snack. And join other Doctor Who and Torchwood and alike fans coming together on Second Life at no extra cost for you. Yes, it's our seasonal meetups on Second Life, and one is coming up on the 21st. That's Saturday, the 21st of August, 2010. Now, that starts at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time and at Second Life Time, and make your adjustments wherever you may be located to your time zone. Now, for more details, go to GallifreyanEmbassy.org, and you'll see up on the top there a article with more information and an intro video. So if you never used Second Life before, it's free to use. And Victor First Morrington was kind enough to create a new video that introduces you to Second Life and our meetups. It's a fun way to come together and have fun, and it's open to everyone as long as you have a fairly modern computer within the last 5 years or so, I would say, and internet connection, and by that I mean broadband internet connection. You can join us. As usual, we'll have a live DJ there playing music. We'll do TARDIS tours, which Victor will lead a TARDIS tour across various areas of Second Life, which are Doctor Who themed, and you can experience the Doctor Who experience in the land of Katrina. Once again, for more information, go to our website, GallifreyanEmbassy.org or Podchuck.net, and find the article on the front page. Join us on Second Life this Saturday, the 21st of August. Now, if you did want to meet up in a physical location, one option is Why not meet up at Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy? They have locations in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, and they also have a new store now in Bellevue, Washington. They sell Doctor Who action figures, CDs, comics, and more. They also sell board games, role-playing games, card games, graphic novels, and, as you know, a whole lot more. So check them out. Check out their website at dlair.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. They are celebrating their 24th anniversary, just as we're celebrating Doctor Who, well, Doctor Who Podcast celebrating its 5th anniversary, and the Gallifreyan Embassy is celebrating its 25th. So please wish them well. You can also give them a call at 512-454-2399. Once again, that's Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. Check out their locations in person in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, or Bellevue, Washington. And again, check them out on the internet at dlair.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. Alrighty, well.
All right. Well, is that doing it for Doctor Who Podshock, or are we...
I guess so. I think there's not really anything in the way of feedback, really, that
well, there was some feedback, in by the way. We've overextended ourselves, yes. I do believe.
I fear, yes.
Because we received a few emails, and...
Well, we've got some quite exciting reviews coming up, interviews, haven't we, coming up? So maybe
in lieu of a DVD review on the next episode, I think we have a very nice interview heading your way. So
yes,
if all goes well, we're just trying to finalize that now.
Yeah, and maybe we can have some feedback at the end of the interview as well. So that because I know we've been a bit lax on it lately.
All right, well, I think that's going to wrap things up then for this episode.
Yeah, thanks ever so much to Amy for joining us, Amy.
Anything you would like
really
to
add? Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for revealing my cougar status and also for being patient with me. Thank you, guys. Thanks for asking
Any
me.
Any projects or anything you would like to talk about before we head off?
Well, we're not okay. yet.
All right. I didn't want to put you on the spot, but I didn't want to...
Is your new website up and running, the one for the next project?
Yeah, it's not up right now. Hopefully very soon I'll let you talk me into announcing it. But we had to take a bit of a technical problem with it. GoDaddy, thank you. But once it's up, I'll let you guys know.
Like, now we have an excuse to get you back on the show.
All of the Podshock listeners, a big favor, please think good thoughts for us. We need your help. good thoughts for the next couple of weeks here. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Amy.
Go away, Amy.
Remember, you can be part of the Doctor Who Podshock and Gallifreyan Embassy community by visiting our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net. Both will bring you to the same place. You can join in on the lively forums there, and there are blog entries there, and news and updates, and all things Doctor Who at thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net. You can also follow us all on Twitter, and instead of giving us all our Twitter addresses, just go to our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net, and in the left-hand sidebar there's a link there to follow us on Twitter with all our addresses there. So until next time, cheers, everyone.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Doctor Who Podshock, presented by the fan-run GallifreyanEmbassy.org. Doctor Who is owned and trademarked by the BBC. Doctor Who Podshock is not affiliated with the BBC in any way. Come back next time for another exciting and informative episode of Doctor Who Podshock. You can email us at feedback@podshock.net. Doctor Who Podshock theme music by Jeff Smith at thejeffsmith.com. This has been a production of Art Trap Productions and is presented to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible in part by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you.
You're making Goths into a hero?
If heroes don't exist, it is necessary to invent them. Good for public morale.
And the Doctor's part in all this?
Best forgotten.